And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
We have been having crazy wildfires, both in Northern California and here in
Santa Ana's have blown in, have they?
Yes. And everyone from Thousand Oaks all the way through Malibu were evacuated. We have thousands, I guess, of homes destroyed. Numerous lives lost. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that really just kicked me in the pants about this was realizing that where the fire breaks out, where the first evacuations take place here in Southern California, and I don't mean to dismiss Northern California fires. These are every bit as terrible, and there has been loss of life and structure and historic places. I don't have the same personal connection, obviously, and also I'm just not inundated by that information. But the
right,
but the where here in Southern California it broke out and where the evacuations first started was the same community where 12 of its citizens were shot and killed in a bar the day before. So that's a kick in the pants. That makes you just go, you know, of all places, don't these people deserve a pass? Right now, right next to Thousand Oaks is Agoura Hills, and you've got Calabasas in there. And sure enough, within a few hours, my beloved Paramount Ranch was no more.
Where we went and saw the silent movie, and you saw many silent movies
twice a year, at least. I would go to Paramount Ranch for Silence Under the Stars. I would often go there to hike. It is, as we've talked about on this show, it was once the actual production rents for Paramount Pictures where so many movies were made going back 100 years. And it's become part of the National Forest Service. But an old Western town was maintained there and, in fact, had renewed prominence as the Main Street location in the TV series Westworld. And
Wow. So
it is, and it was replete with a working soundstage too. And it is destroyed. Now, all the news coverage is that, you know, just at Paramount Ranch burnt to the ground. Now, most of the ranch are hiking paths and running paths and, you know, 100-year-old oak trees. And I don't know the status of, you know, those trees. It doesn't bode well, as denizens of Malibu know. You know, the fire just swept up over the hill and came down burning everything like a fire. It was described as a fire tornado.
Right. And, which often is a thing. A fire tornado happens when an updraft and the heat turns the flame into a circular motion and makes it impossible to pour water on or any of those fire retardants. And it's a weather phenomena at that point.
And you hear reports of natural disasters, you know, although I'm at the point, as you know, and this we'll save this for another day, but with what mankind has done to the environment via climate change, via overdevelopment and other things. I'm not sure we can call these things natural disasters anymore. They are certainly man-aided natural disasters, aren't they? I mean,
I guess, right?
The size of them, the impact of them in these. But when I see these reports and, you know, you'll see people who willfully ignored usually these evacuation orders.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but there's a part of me that's going, what are they doing? What are they doing? Right? Everything can be replaced, right? But they cannot.
Right.
And such is my misanthrope that I am, such is my affection for human life and the loss of human potential, right?
Right. But now, I thought there was laws, very strict laws, about fire breaks, about cutting back the underbrush away from your house by 50 to 100 feet. All of these things were supposed to, in the chance of a wildfire, stop it from coming to your house, that you kept that clear by law.
Yeah, but I don't know if that can do it. When burning embers, there was a reporter in Oak Park at the end of a cul-de-sac, and I don't really have a point. I just really enjoyed needing a laugh and saying cul-de-sac. But he was at the end of the street in Oak Park, and one house was on fire. One. And, of course, right. It was random. It was all the way at the end of the cul-de-sac, in the far end of it, in the right corner. And it's because the burning ember had flown 1 mile through the air and landed there. So there's nothing, really, when these kick up, that's going to do. Maintaining your fucking garden, Haglund, isn't going to do it. But anyway, I suddenly really... hair on the back of my neck standing up, and just as if I wasn't already wounded enough from Paramount Ranch, just suddenly drop to my knees when I hear, because this drives it home, that, you know, Malibu High School on Guernsey, I think it is, no more. It is no more. Well, of course, you know, just down the street, 5-minute walk from there, Lee and Carla McCloskey's place.
Right.
And Olandar, really, and the Olandar Foundation for Emerging Renaissance, and
all that artwork.
The hieroglyph of the human soul, the irreplaceable three-dimensional artwork that we showed in The Truth Is Out There, but honestly, it's twice the size that it was then. And he has built, when we're out on the patio in that movie, and he's showing you a painting that had just emerged outside, right? The painting work had just gone outside. There's now an add-on out there, a whole other room where that patio was. So enormous, the work continues. I hope it will continue. Every single home and tree up and down Phillip Avenue and Guernsey Avenue, all around them, burnt to the ground the first night.
Oh my God.
Their house did not, because they ignored the evacuation orders and they fought it off all night long with
hoses or
with garden hoses and with fire extinguishers. They kept wetting down. I mean, I guess this is a big tip. They kept wetting down. They kept utterly soaked their roof all night.
Wow.
And then fire extinguishers. So that was the good news. The morning came and the Santa Anas died down, and Lee and Carla and their house was still standing. Their animals were still standing. Hopefully the smoke inhalation with the masks that they had was okay. But here's the thing, of course. Then you realize, you know, the winds are coming back. The fire advisory is in effect until Tuesday. And they're out of water after one night and out of extinguishers. So I've been trying the best I can to get updates, but it's hard because it's evacuated, because we don't live in a time of landlines anymore.
Right.
And one of the first things in these emergencies that happen is the towers either shut off.
Burn down.
Or they burn down. Yeah, but you know, but they try to keep the airwaves clear for emergency channels. And anyway, so it's been tough. I did a supply boat from Oxnard was being sent to Zuma Beach by them and Point Doom, I think it was. And then that had to be canceled. One was going from Santa Monica, though, last night. And it seemed like from the supplies that were going on that the fight was continuing. But just crazy. I mean, this real life. I mean, I there's nothing I can compare it to. There's nothing in my life that I can. I mean, I thought the real life drama of trying to save my cat was a big deal, but this is extraordinary,
big deal.
And extraordinarily dangerous. But I mean, I don't want to get overly poetic about this, but the amount of tears that would shed from people to whom Olendar and the McCloskeys and that artwork, you know, means so much to so many people, that the amount of tears that would be shed if something happened to them, to the artwork, to that Olendar Foundation, if those tears themselves could be bottled and sent back in time, they would have enough water to protect that house for a long, long time. What they ended up doing was connecting hoses to connecting a hydrant to some of the swimming pools in the Ritzy Malibu area there. And that helped replenish the water supply.
Oh, that's clever. I can't imagine how that's done, but yeah.
That's why they're called firemen. The firemen did that, and I don't know.
Oh, I see. So, but yeah. So, okay. So everything's burnt down. So there's no fuel then left.
Well,
but embers are still flying through the air, is what you're saying.
Flying through the air, and of course the, and I guess there's always fuel. I mean, for these vicious fires, you know, like one report I heard was that this dead avocado grove in the area that is just tinder. It completely bypassed altogether. So there is plenty of fuel still left, apparently.
I see.
And,
right.
Because it doesn't move at ground level. That's the crazy thing about this stuff, right? I mean, so I don't know. This seems incredible.
It does. And you know, every fire season, I've always remarked, we've had very close friends who, almost lost their house, in the fire. That was, the Holy Cross fire down, near San Diego. And, that was last season, I guess, not even a year ago, but, you know, they manufactured this stuff that you spray on the side of your house that was invented by your firemen who noticed that a warehouse full of Pampers diapers didn't burn. And the absorbent material in that is a water-soluble material that you could spray on the side of your house that absorbs the heat and protects your house from burning down. And yes, it is $500 for 2 gallons. That covers, I don't know, 300 square feet or so. But it saves your house in a raging wildfire. And then after the fire goes, you just wash it off and you go back to living in your house. And I'm always surprised that nobody applies this stuff.
Well, I'm hoping to hell that it's not it wasn't the recyclable section of that Pampers warehouse where he noticed it. Because then that secret ingredient is baby urine.
Okay. So you just grossed me out. I never even... Why did you say that?
All right. Hey, we have a celebrity death to get to before we talk about movies. And I think it's one that you may know well.
Celebrity deaths.
We got an email from our friend Stephen Fowler of the Smokin' All-Stars, the proprietor of Booksmith Quality Used Books in Nelson, British Columbia. He writes, Phil and Dean.
That's us.
Yeah, there you go. I was waiting. Wow. My soundboard of Dean Haglund expressions is delayed this morning.
That's you know, it's a time delay.
Yeah, you move closer and there's a time delay. Here's the latest edition of Fresh Sheet, a weekly newsletter about mainly Vancouver theater by my friend and longtime critic and playwright Colin Thomas.
Yes, I know Colin.
I forward this to you because it contains an obituary of Vancouver actor David Peterson.
Oh.
I never met him myself, but many of my friends knew and loved him. I think Dean might have been one of those friends.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. This is terrible news. What happened?
Vancouver actor David Peterson died from bone cancer on Friday, November 2nd, in St. John Hospice at UBC. He was 71. Actor Nicola Lippman, his partner of 7 years, was with him. Peterson was active in the early days of the Tammany House Theater.
Tammany, yes. That's a very famous theater company, theater space in Vancouver.
It's described in this article as being one of Vancouver's foundational companies. So that's a big deal.
That's a big deal.
But I knew of this next one because of you. He worked extensively with the Caravan Farm Theater in Armstrong.
Yes. I know.
Will you describe this real quick, the Caravan Theater in Armstrong?
Yes. This is a holdover from an earlier time, but it is it used to be a roving theater company that had a team of horses that would take the stage on a flatbed from town to town and perform plays outdoors. So it would be an outdoor roving theater company, and they eventually settled in the interior of British Columbia near Armstrong, and have a semi-permanent stage, still outdoors, still a fantastic. They do a season, of course, in the summer, and the day I went, it was rained out. So their play will actually stop if there's too much rain. So you're affected by weather.
Oh, much like our president's armistice celebration.
Exactly. Yes. How precisely identical. So, the Caravan Theater, and they went as far as San Francisco in the 70s, up and down the west coast of the U.S.
Is this the same Caravan Theater where, if memory serves, your sister met her companion?
John was the horse guy, and she did the set decoration and props, and thus began a long relationship.
And John, of course, figures prominently in The Truth Is Out There also.
Absolutely, when we were up at their farm. So, this is a big first time hearing of this David Peterson.
Yeah, his bone cancer. His most significant film role that people might know was the lead in the movie Skip Tracer in 1977, in which he played opposite John Lazarus. He also appeared in the movies The Gray Fox, which I enjoyed quite a bit of when I was a young guy, and a movie called Big Meat Eater, which I don't know. But
right.
For the latter, he wrote song lyrics along with Barbara Williams. He performed in a number of TV series. One of these guys who just a fixture on probably every show that filmed in Canada, right, as a guest star.
Yeah.
Including The Beachcombers, Da Vinci's Inquest, Cold Squad, and, of course, The X-Files.
Yes.
So, now, there will be a celebration of David Peterson's life at the Performing Arts Lodge on November 25th. The time has yet to be finalized. But I wanted to share this one little piece about him. There were so many stories in this article about what just a great, great man and loyal, supportive friend this man seemed to be. He has requested cremation and that his clown nose be in his pocket with him.
Oh, that's so lovely. I didn't know you could request such things.
David Peterson, 71, thank you for that, Stephen Fowler. Always good
thanks,
to hear
Stephen.
From a friend. You know, speaking of November 2015, Dean, of which I just mentioned, a future live event of the week is taking place that night.
Would that be your birthday?
Well, yeah, my birthday. is taking place that day, but it is qualifying as a live event of the week because I will be turning 50 years old on stage as I host a variety show that will serve as a fundraiser for the Los Angeles Breakfast Club set during the final hour of 1949 on New Year's Eve. Why on the final hour? New Year's 1949? Because they were saying then, as I am saying now, goodbye 40s, hello 50s. That is the theme of the variety show. And people, if they're going to be in the Los Angeles area, if they're within the sound of my voice, quite frankly,
yes,
they can check out EncoreSundays.eventbrite.com, EncoreSundays.eventbrite.com, and they can learn all the details and get tickets.
Wow. So it's going to be a wild, wild party, is what
yes.
you're saying.
Yes.
At the Breakfast Club and on a Sunday night. Show entertainment. There will be songs. What are you going to perform yourself?
I am indeed. I'm the MC. There will be it's all period appropriate entertainment. I will be doing a Bob Hope-esque monologue, and all the jokes are taken from that year. From
really?
From Bob Hope monologues, from Jack Benny monologues. I have jokes
that,
about
actually.
The big upcoming Rose Bowl game. I've got I got a lot of Russian jokes because Russian meddling and interference was a big topic in 1949. and back
who,
then
who Russians? No, I guess
no
not.
Russians, the Soviets.
No, I know yeah. Russian. Yes,
and,
yes.
And they and back then they were really scared. You know, it was the dawn of the Cold War, and they were really scared because. In the recent elections, or in the upcoming elections in 1950, the Democrats were going to take control of the House, and people were getting really scared because without the Republicans controlling Congress to keep them safe from the Russians, what would they do?
How times have changed.
Yeah,
right?
They do change sometimes, and they stay
right.
the same, and clearly they and... stay the same. So there will be magic. There will be puppetry. There will be musical performances. The Ohio State Buckeye Marching Band will be on stage.
What?
And the great Betty Davis will be making an appearance. And so much more. So please join us.
Betty Davis?
Yeah.
How did you get her?
I used my show business connections, you know. It's not 6 degrees of separation in show business, Dean, as you know. It's two degrees here.
It's two degrees, absolutely. Everybody knows everybody.
Actually, this morning it's probably 60 degrees, and I'm dressed like it's 2 degrees. Because I'm a wimp.
Okay. You know, I'm looking at snow right now here in Michigan, so don't even joke about it.
All right, so this is the busy time of year, quite frankly, in Hollywood, because all the award hopeful movies are coming out. Like Lily said, last night I am so tired of movie screenings, you know, because they are challenging. Now let's put this in perspective: spending night after night, day after day, fighting fires away from your home. Challenging?
Mm-hmm.
Probably not. Not the same degree of challenging. But God bless her. Lily Holloman has been fighting the good fight in this Hollywood awards season. you know, 7 movie screenings in 9 nights for her. And it's bizarre because you lose sight of what movies are actually out in theaters because we're seeing these sometimes months before they actually, you know, come out. But it was a big week of movie screenings for us, and I want to hit several of them. One, because it's a continuation of a conversation we were having last week apropos of some of the movies I discussed. But this one is What They Had, and it's another Sundance pickup, I think, from a writer-director Elizabeth Shomko. I think it might have been her narrative debut. It stars Hilary Swank, Michael Shannon, Robert Forster, and Blythe Danner. How about that for
Ooh,
a foursome? Right
that's there? A good one.
And,
yeah.
And they're all quite good, especially at different times in the movie. They play a family. That's the first problem. I never quite buy. Like in scenes with Michael Shannon and Hilary Swank, I go, yeah, I could see them as brother and sister. And with Michael Shannon and Robert Forster, yeah, I could see them as father and son. And with Blythe Danner and Hilary Swank, I go, okay, I can see them as, but together, like, no. All right, this does not this was cast by agents that packaged this movie. You know?
Oh, right.
But you know, and what I want to doff my cap to is that this is a movie that is about Alzheimer's. Again, it's called What They Had, and some of the tough decisions that people have to make, families have to make, and what happens to caretakers in those situations, in those families. And it's all fertile ground for exploration, obviously, in films and in storytellings. There's more than one story that can be made about this. But I will say two things. One, it's another one of these movies that a lot of people are going to give a pass to because it's honorable. And I sort of feel like critics doing that with this. And I mentioned A Private War, you know, about Marie Colvin last week with Rosamund Pike.
Yeah.
Since talking about that, oh my God, in the wake of some of Trump's most recent attacks on the media, now the reviewers are falling all over themselves, loving that movie. And I think it's a direct response to the political era in which we live.
Right.
Because that movie didn't get better from one week to the next.
No, but it's everything is seen in context. All art is in context of what's happening. So this is why Blade Runner is now really awesome. Whereas in 1982, when it came out, everybody hated it. So
I have Trump's attacks on the media to thank for Blade Runner being rediscovered. Okay, well, good.
Not quite. No.
No, I understand that. I do understand that. I guess what I'm saying, though, is that this is kind of that counter case, Dean, where we're not talking about a movie getting rejected because of context. We're talking about a movie being embraced entirely because of context.
And well, because now it's resonating differently.
Yes, yeah. And so, but it is the opposite, right? That once you free yourself of context, the beauty of something can actually be discovered, the genuine, authentic beauty, the unique beauty of it.
Right.
But what often will happen with these noble award hopeful movies, if they've managed to hit the zeitgeist at the right time, is that you let a little time pass and suddenly people go, oh, wow, the emperor has no clothes.
Exactly.
And so what they had to a degree is that again. I doff my cap at it because for this topic, they mined a fairly pleasing tone and a remarkable amount of humor out of it. As these performers are capable of doing, you know, I mean, these are four performers that are really adept at keeping you going along with some pretty dark material at times.
Right.
Right. Because of their innate charms, and they lend those charms well to these characters. But structurally, it doesn't know whose film it is, and you never quite believe what you're seeing. And that is too bad because I get the feeling it's very autobiographical of what this writer director experienced with her parents. So the fact that it does not smack of verisimilitude is really sad, I think.
Right. That is sad. But I'm reminded then I would just be comparing this to that that other movie with Gordon Pinsent.
Well, of course, of Julie Christie. Yeah. Well, that's the Julie kind of Christie, the high watermark, yeah. And you've kind of got to put that in your hip pocket and go, all right, it's unfair to compare it. But you're talking about Away From Her, directed by Sarah Pauley.
Yeah. And that, to me, is like, in terms of exploring Alzheimer's, that's the one that you will compare all other movies to. So if it's not holding up even as a family drama, I imagine it's going to sink on that capacity too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. Well, I mean, and sadly, that is what the review I want to avoid, because as you always say with romantic comedies, if you haven't seen it before, then the formula is fresh to you.
Right.
And so again, you don't want to be too in context. You want to say out of context, does this work? And that's why I'm saying structurally, no, I don't think it works. And I think an audience might not know why they're not believing it, but they're not believing it. And sometimes casting and chemistry plays a part in that. But you're right. if it is a topic you want to explore, and this is a topic that touches everybody, if it hasn't touched everybody already, just give it time, right? But Away From Her, I think, continues not only in context of the time was it hailed, but I think the appreciation for that movie has only grown.
Right. Yeah, exactly. All right. Again, in context, you see how hard it is to make a good one.
Three other screenings that I want to discuss. I'll talk about the movies a little bit individually, but it leads into a larger theme that we need to explore. Toot sweet, apparently, because this caught me off guard, honestly. Last week, I talked about Orson Welles' new old film,
yes,
his new release on Netflix, The Other Side of the Wind. And God bless Netflix for enabling this to finally get finished and for giving it not only a streaming date, but it's out in theaters and it's had an awards push. I mean, wouldn't it be amazing if Orson Welles got a Best Director nomination, which, you know,
wouldn't that be?
Would have been the first time since Citizen Kane. I mean, that would have wouldn't that be incredible? There's a documentary, right, about the making of that and about him that dropped day and date called You'll Love Me When I'm Dead. And it's made by Morgan Neville, 50 Feet from Stardom, and the Won't You Be My Neighbor, this year's Oscar frontrunner for documentary. And Netflix produced that and has released that as well and is pushing that for award consideration. But in years past, you know, Netflix has been trying to get into the big screen feature game where, you know, these are the kind of movies that could get awards. The way that Amazon Prime has done very, very well. And and Netflix has fallen behind. And the attitude has been kind of, you know what, stick to television shows and Emmy Awards, because that's where you're really doing well.
Right.
Well, this year is the change in that, starting with the Orson Welles film. I saw an advanced screening of a movie that opens, I think it is December 18th. It's called Bird Box. I saw it two nights before its world premiere, which is tonight. It's an upcoming American post-apocalyptic horror film directed by Susanna Bier, who did the wonderful After the Wedding about a decade ago, you know, which launched Mads Mikkelsen into next level international stardom and was one of my favorite films of the last decade. It's from a screenplay by Eric Hesserer, writer of Arrival, Denis Villeneuve's Arrival, and it's based on the 2014 novel of the same name. And get this cast, it stars probably most reliable box office star on the planet, Sandra Bullock.
Right.
And then a who's who of independent films. Sarah Paulson, Trevante Rhodes, the star of Moonlight, Oscar-winning Moonlight. Jackie Weaver, Oscar-nominated star of Animal Kingdom. How about John Malkovich, for crying out loud? Tom Hollander, who, in addition to appearing on Broadway in Travesties with Dan Butler this year, is in every single movie that comes out these days. B.D. Wong, Machine Gun Kelly, Pruitt Taylor Vince. It is a who's who of independent film. And it's been made by Netflix, and it gets a theatrical release on December 11th before going streaming on December 18th. And of all the parent-child facing the apocalypse together movies, which is a new subgenre, I'm realizing. I'm thinking off the top of my head of Cormac McCarthy's The Road. I'm thinking of earlier this year's A Quiet Place.
Right.
This one's the most fun. This one has a two-tiered narrative track, two different timelines, and one brings great kind of zombie horror film fun to the mix, and the other brings great harrowing humans overcoming nature and the obstacles and finding themselves through that struggle kind of narrative thrust. So there's a lot of really good things in it. And in some ways, watching Sandra Bullock blindfolded for half the movie, because your main characters are blindfolded for much of the movie, which prevents actors from expressing with their eyes. And they're blindfolded because you can't look at it. You can't look at it. You can't look at what's going on. So it's a certain madness that descends when you look at it.
That's interesting.
Yeah, kind of a Medusa effect sort of a thing. But anyway, when I'm watching Sandra Bullock do this, walk through this movie blindfolded and trying to survive with these two little kids and a woman playing a woman for whom the idea of motherhood is so disowned, even though she is a mother. It's such an interesting parallel to Gravity, where we're watching her float through this whole movie kind of blind, trying to make it back to Earth after losing a child, right? And trying to come to grips with that. It's such an interesting parallel to that. A fascinating enough movie. I appreciated that it was fun. For the first time, one of these post-apocalyptic kind of parent-child movies was fun. And something that would lose a lot of enjoyment and a lot of suspense and tension if you're watching at home and not on a big screen.
Why?
Well, because they really use the big screen. They really use it. They really use being immersed in that setting to great effect. This is a big screen movie that Netflix has made, and most people are not going to get the chance to see it that way. Also, a fascinating thing that the director said when asked how much the budget was, she said, "We always lie about these things." She literally was not allowed to know. So Netflix not only does not reveal how many people watch their things, they also don't reveal to the people making them what they cost either.
So what, they just supply you with everything you want?
Yes, yeah. What do you want? And then we'll say, that's absolutely right. What do you want? And then they say yes or no.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, either that's really freeing or that's so intimidating. I can't think of which. Because normally, we're from the independent world, you're cost-cutting as much as possible and thinking of ways of doubling up on sets and all that sort of thing.
So
I can't. Yeah. I can't imagine just a here, do whatever you want scenario.
Trevante, they might say no, and they will walk away from things, but they decide, and you don't get to know the financial parameters involved in them making that decision. Trevante Rhodes, so great to see in this film, getting to play this really nurturing man of action in this film. It opens the doorway for some more kind of action figures, I must say. As you have championed long ago, as long as this show has been on, if you're going to make an action movie, you probably better have a female lead. And this is another exemplar of that. But the character that Trevante Rhodes, this veteran that he plays, this kind of wounded veteran, and yet someone who still is fully in touch with his humanity and his nurturing side. It is such a refreshing masculine hero for a film. And I think only happens because a really strong, insightful woman who showed us a different side of masculinity with Mads Mikkelsen in After the Wedding. And oh, by the way, that enables him to become this huge international star. Only someone like that director would be capable of it. So a lot to enjoy in that movie. It streams starting December 21st in theaters 1 week prior to that, I believe it is.
Cool.
Okay. I saw Roma. Now, Roma is been winning top awards, including, I think, the Golden Lion in the Venice Film Festival, where it had its premiere on August 30th. It's Mexico's entry for Best Foreign Language Film at the 91st Academy Awards, and it is the first film to be directed by Oscar-winning filmmaker Alfonso Cuarón since the aforementioned Gravity. So how odd that I would see this the day after I see Sandra Bullock's new film. And it was a whole Gravity reunion weekend.
Of course.
And this is a drama film, a black and white 65 millimeter film. It's true widescreen.
Where the hell did he get a 65 millimeter?
Well, remember, there's a handful of directors, including himself, that are keeping film alive. Where the studios had to say, yeah, we'll do this. Tarantino's one, Christopher Nolan's one. So he shot this in super widescreen. We got to watch it projected in super wide screen. It's black and white. It was photographed by Alfonso Cuarón himself. He not only directed, he was the cinematographer on this, because his usual cinematographer, Emmanuel Lubezki, who works with him and with Iñárritu and all their movies, he had to leave the project just a couple weeks before it started shooting. So Cuarón, who knew the approach better than anyone else, just said, okay, I'll do it. In collaboration with this great cinematography team, obviously. And he edited the film, and it is called Roma for the district in Mexico City where he grew up. And it's set in, I think, 1971, right around the time of the second wave of student... Oh, no, it's 68, right before the wave of student uprisings in anticipation of the Olympic Games being held there. And it is a memory piece. It is a black and white memory piece as he looks back. It's almost what I would say was his Amacord. It's fascinating. It long takes, long panning takes. In fact, other than the main character, the protagonist, who is a housekeeper, who is so privileged a few times during the 2 hour and 15 minute running time, there is a series of close-ups when the family is taking a car ride from a beach 2 hours into the movie, and those are the first close-ups in the movie.
Wow.
And this is someone who understands that in classical Hollywood filmmaking, the close-up is something you used when you wanted to... It was your trump card in poker.
Yes.
In filmmaking, it was your trump card. It's what you wanted when you needed to win. And you saved it as a result. That started changing with the advent of television. It certainly has changed with the continued advent of Netflix, which is the company releasing this movie.
Oh my gosh! Wow!
And yet, that's it's a 65mm widescreen film. And to say that you will be losing something, one of the things you'll be losing is the real sacred aspect of this film. There is a real sacred quality, as Fellini used to say, to going into the cinema. And that was true when people like him were making movies. And it's true when you go to see a movie made by Alfonso Cuarón. He makes movies that deserve to be seen on the big screen. And this is not just old man Phil going, kids, you should put away your devices and go and see that. Because I love people seeing movies however they want to see them and then being available however they want to see them. And I love that. I am just saying that I like democracy. I like freedom. I like options. I like people having options. And the problem with this being a Netflix film is most people will not be allowed in this country to see it on the big screen because it's only going to play in theaters for a week before it's available streaming. And how many theaters are going to hold the movie? It's certainly not going to be able to expand if it's available for free on Netflix. So so most people literally outside of LA and New York and maybe San Francisco, nobody's going to get the chance to see it on the big screen.
Well, unless, have you gone to Costco? Those 75-inch monitors now
are
huge.
Yeah, but that's not, and we're talking about with Bird, but this is what I'm saying. I took that into account. I've got a TV up all covering one wall. Don't kid yourself, but it's not the same. And also, when you are at home, you are not immersed in a film.
True.
You're pausing it. You can pause it because I'm going to go make some tea. The dog's barking. Oh, there's a delivery. Oh, there's this. You are not immersed in the world. And that changes the movie. And in these movies, that is diminishing it. That's all I'm saying. I'm not blaming people for wanting to see it that way. I'm just saying that something is lost in these movies. And
Interesting. And
the people who could appreciate that and who could go, all right, my friend in podcasting said something will be lost, so I want to see this on the big screen. Well, sorry, you're not going to get the chance unless you live in New York or LA or maybe San Francisco or something like that. So that's my point. But this will probably win Best Foreign Language Film at the Oscars. And boy, this casts a spell. this movie and really gives you a feel of the time and the place while keeping you at a distance, the distance that one always feels when they're looking back across the ages at their own memories. That's how that film is shot. So incredible. And I have so many fun stories about the making of that I learned at a Q&A that I will not share with you because I want to move on to the third and final award.
Please don't share this.
Award hopeful.
Yeah.
That is out. And that is The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
All right. Now, this is the new Coen Brothers movie, right?
The new Coen Brothers movie. It came out this week in three theaters, one in New York, one in L.A., one in San Francisco. There's those cities again. Not surprising. Their movies often open limited to get award exposure and reviews. Reviews have been fantastic for the movie. And then they open wide, and sometimes these movies actually do break big for the Coen brothers, right?
Yes.
This one will not, because on Friday, it starts streaming on Netflix. I did not go to Netflix screenings, by the way. I mean, I wasn't going out of my way. These are just award screenings, and it's every big movie is owned by Netflix. So take that, Amazon Prime, I guess, but take that rest of the industry. We are all now owned by Netflix. The freaking Coen brothers are now not a wide theatrical release brand. They are now a Netflix brand.
Right.
And saddest of all, their movie was shot 16:9. Theirs was shot home television aspect ratio. It's an anthology Western film. It's six different separate chapters in an anthology. They do not overlap, except thematically. I love this theme. Stories never die. People always do. and it's it begins as a ludicrous, hilarious, wonderful comedy musical Western starring Tim Blake Nelson.
Wow.
And it descends into some of the darkest, bleakest, most disturbing drama starring Liam Neeson and a limbless man, and with stops for Shaggy Dog bank robbing jokes starring James Franco. And wagon train, emotional romance pieces starring Zoe Kazan along the way. Each one of these chapters is so good. And here's a movie that may actually be helped by being on Netflix, because you could stop after each chapter if you wanted to savor it and then come back to it. Because I don't know about you, but I don't think I'm alone in this. And certainly this was Lily's feeling. She doesn't have the experience with anthology movies that I do, but she did describe something that happens, especially when they're good, when the chapters are good, is that the reset is a little bit exhausting. When you finish a chapter and then having to reset and get back up on that horse, if you will.
To start a new story.
It's tiring. Yes. And so she was really exhausted by the end of the movie and therefore not enjoying some of the later chapters as much, which is interesting because in most anthology films that I can think of, usually there's one or two kind of stinkers, and that actually helps propel you into later ones because you go, okay, good. Maybe this one will be good. Thank God that's over. Maybe this one will be
right,
good.
Right, right. Yeah, it's your sorbet between your main course and your dessert or entree, let's say.
Yeah.
Entree and main course, you need a little... aperitif in there. Is that saying that this doesn't have any of that? It's
I love courses. Sorbet, as in, boy, that section made my ass sorbet.
See what you did?
So, you know, this is a lot of fun. I mean, if you're a Coen Brothers fan, you'll love it. If you're a Western fan, you'll love it. It one of the things that's great about it is it tiptoes into something that I think has been a growing awareness, which is there are so many stories that have never been explored in the Old West. So many types of stories, so many types of characters. And this film little opens up different chapters about many of them. And so who knows what might come of this. But I loved it, and I was at a screening at the my first ever visit to the refurbished IMAX Chinese Theater to see it. And the Coen brothers introduced it along with the cast. And one of the performers performed authentic Western numbers before the movie. And so it was great. Ooh. It was great fun. And it was kind of the big splashy kind of cinematic presentation of it that the movie will not get at any other time because it's streaming on Netflix.
So, but Netflix has a war horse of $8 billion that they're putting into film and television. And you remember that early in the evolution of Netflix, they got into independent film financing and made a big, or soon got out of it when they realized that that was a hopeless avenue to pursue. So I don't know if you're disparaging Netflix or celebrating.
To correct, they didn't get out of that. They're still producing enormous amounts of independent films and may indeed be producing a certain independent film that I'm really, really fingers crossed is getting made at a budget level that I want it to be. So let me just stop there. But so they're still supporting independent films, but they're supporting it for the streaming service. What you were talking about was that they were making independent films that were being released theatrically through, I think, Red Envelope was, I think, the name of their company then. And they realized that that didn't make sense. And indeed, the only way it really does make sense for them, and where I wouldn't put it past them, is, man, if they owned their own theaters and sold a subscription service to the theaters, there's a business model for them that would work. Because we know these subscription services are popular, and then if they could own the concession sales at these theaters, well, they would make money hand over fist. And so it would be an extension. It would be your home in a movie theater. And they would do really well. But there are still laws in place preventing that. You know, laws against monopolies, right?
They could own
a couple of theaters. But this is why there was never the Paramount chain of movie theaters back during the Golden Age, right? You couldn't do that. You couldn't own production, distribution, and exhibition. But I'm at the point where for the safety of, I don't know, the film, the legacy of film itself, God, maybe we change that rule to allow them to do it.
Right.
But they are the biggest player right now in theatrical motion pictures. All of a sudden, it dropped in 1 year. They are the biggest player in theatrical motion pictures in that they have all the best talent under their tent.
Right, because they're, well, it's the freedom and it's the... it sounds from other stories I've heard that they're not saying, can the couch be blue? Can the dog be a cat when doing script review? They're just saying yes or no. And then what do you need?
What are you doing? And what do you need? And you get a yes or a no. And it doesn't sound like those things change unless your leading man is revealed to be a sexual predator. And then we force you to write him out of the show and we make Robin Wright the star. But other than that, they're not really getting involved. I think that is an outlier.
I hope so.
So the times they are changing. And again, I want to just, I have some alarm bells going off about that because I was so hopeful of the big screen motion picture earlier this summer, though maybe this continues to help independence all the more. If the biggest name talent is going to Netflix, and as we know, people will still want to go to the theaters, does it not give independents and smaller films more of a chance to stand out?
Right.
Because you're finding the biggest names at home. I mean, you don't have to compete. If you're an independent comedy, you don't have to compete really anymore with big budget comedies because they don't make them for the big screen. Right. I mean, so anyway, we'll see that. And one more hopeful story to come out of this Netflix experience shared by Sandra Bullock. And I think you'll love this. She was telling a story about the biggest challenge because, you know, people in audiences love to ask that question. What's the biggest challenge? They also love when they're in the audience to tell the people up on stage about themselves before asking questions. But we'll just jump ahead to the question, which was about the biggest challenge. And she talked about filming in this fantastic house, this fantastic craftsman house, which I think is in, I know where it is, in Pasadena. But there's these trees that were dropping these acorns, I think it was, all during the shooting. And one particularly dramatic scene on this metal roof, acorns were just falling throughout it. And she is in just the throes of this emotion, you know, this emotional outburst. You know, the tears are flowing and the anguish, and 10 takes are ruined by the sound.
No.
And after 10 takes, she's out. She's dry. And they have to do 10 more, and she still doesn't have anything, you know?
Oh,
but
my God.
Now the sound's good, but she's done, and they've been doing this for a long time. And I think, you know, this is what can happen to actors, right? And all of a sudden, yeah. She says she sees Big John Malkovich, Big Bear John Malkovich, lumbering around the corner and making a beeline straight for her, you know, just staring at her. And she said, oh, my God, he's going to hit me. You know, how dare you waste all our time, amateur? And instead he comes right up to her and he wraps those gigantic arms around her and enfolds her in a big bear hug. And does not let go until she releases. And as she releases, the waterworks begin again. And she just, and she has it back. And without saying a word, he just walks off in the other direction. And, you know, he wasn't even in the scene. And he just knew what was going on and knew what was needed. You know, the sensitivity of that actor's tool to know and his experience. And Lily heard this story and said, I think every actor every day needs the Malkovich hug.
It's kind of true. I can use one of those every now and then.
Yeah,
probably every day.
So I'm gonna. So from now on set, we'll refer the Malkovich hug. It's gonna be a good.
That's good.
All right,
that's a good story.
Before we go, did you watch a movie last night?
I sure did.
What did you watch?
A little something called The Lady Killers.
What? Now is this a remake of the 1955 Ealing classic that everyone wants to know so that they can reveal that they have seen an old movie or read an article about film at some point?
No, it is definitely not a remake of the classic Peter Sellers, Al Guinness comedy of robbery gone wrong.
Yeah,
no.
It's not even spelled the same way. It's their movies and the Coen Brothers movie, The Lady Killers, one word. Ours is Lady Space Killers, and that's very
right.
Important, not just for finding the film, but for enjoying the film, honestly. The Lady Killers. So what did you think, Dean Haglund, of having seen finally the finished film?
Well, this is fascinating. From seeing it, the rough cut, I am remarked at the flow is so much different than I remember it. How this is so much smoother. I think it's fantastic. The changes that have been made. So,
this
course,
is when
you
say the flow. I mean, this was the interesting kind of unique challenge. It's an ensemble piece. In addition to being a really crazy dark comedy, really, increasingly brutal dark comedy. It's a big ensemble piece, and so you have what was interesting when we were making it. Right, was there was this feel of almost like we were making seven different short films.
Right.
You know, with each one following a different one of these seven characters. And so there's that aspect. And you go, okay, well, how is this going to flow when it's seven different short films? But then also stylistically, as you know, there's a major, major plot shift. At the end of Act Two. And at that point, stylistically, it becomes an entirely different movie. And so,
yes. So
you literally, style-wise, have two different movies. One that's Act 1 and 2, and then one that's Act 3. And so you've got seven different short films, two different stylistic films. How is this all going to flow? And the truth is the answer is twofold. One, that the structure on paper worked. It is still a three-act structure. And and almost nail on head three-act structure. This is one of the times where I was so devoted to that structure, and I'm glad I am, because it's one of the things that gives you a real handle on it. That here, not only are the act breaks coming at the right time, but we're letting you know that they're here by giving you a fade out.
Yes.
And then the other thing about it is the music on your phone really helps people know what movie they're watching throughout. No, the tone of the film and all that goes into it lets you know, like one woman, one of the writers on and producers on the Netflix show Grace and Frankie, when she was writing a peer review of the film, she said there was an element of this film that no matter how harrowing or awful this got, let me know that I was being taken care of and that it was going to be all right.
That's tone. Right. So there you go. Well done on the tone. As we speak of all the time, tone being crucially important and yet so hard to do. So I think I enjoyed that. I enjoyed tone for a change.
Are you struck by how, you know, this has been a long, arduous path getting this movie out to people?
Yeah.
Are you struck by, of course it had to be now.
Yes, in terms of context, in terms of, as we were just talking about, arts and context, in terms of Me Too and the shift in terms of misogyny in all its forms and what this film addresses, it is actually amazing. And, we talked about this at length in the production, but now it seems to be not just resonate more, but more believable than it was earlier. That to me is the most incredible aspect of it. It's believability.
Well, yeah, that's two different things that you're absolutely right about. One is, the believability, because one of the reasons in context this movie got rejected, and when I say rejected, not that, oh, that's bad. It's that, first of all, people wouldn't watch it. They literally would not watch it for the longest time. But one of the things that we heard literally was, this doesn't exist anymore. This misogyny doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
Once it finally, once we finally had our world premiere, oh my God, somebody who's there comes up to us in, complete, not anonymity. We knew who they were, but, this was just completely in confidence. So the details can't be revealed, but let us know that at the nonprofit where she works in Washington, D.C., employees were just outed for playing this very game.
Right.
This is a nonprofit. And of course, in the armed forces, stories come out at university, story come out. As I say, honestly, the game that's being alluded to in our movie or being shown in our movie, I mean, these are the games that are being alluded to really by Brett Kavanaugh and his friends all throughout that confirmation hearing. Right. They weren't drinking games, for crying out loud.
No.
If people are willing to say, oh, I guess not only does this stuff exist, but it's driving a lot of our conversation subtextually in ways that we didn't appreciate before.
Right. Exactly.
So you got to shine a light into the darkness so that we can start to form a relationship to these things. But the other thing is, I don't think it's just misogyny. I do think it's exploitation. Because the way these guys exploit not only women, that's a big part of it, obviously, is the exploitation of women, but also exploit each other and also exploit their own resources. It's all unhealthy, problematic, and going to lead to devastating results. I had a conversation with someone after seeing it, and they said, not all exploitation is bad. And I said, oh, this will be good. Explain this to me. I said, well, it depends on whether it's for good or not. Are you exploiting it for good or are you exploiting it? And I said, I guess what you're saying is if you're exploiting it for like the greater good for, versus, your own, self-fulfillment of immediate gratifications of ego and things, that there's a distinction there. And they said, yes. And I said, no, there's not. And just think about ourselves. You know, the there's a difference between exploiting something and making use of something.
When
people feel useful, they feel good. When they feel used, no matter what the end result was, no matter the end justifying the means, you know how they feel? They feel used. And we do that to ourselves. We force ourselves. We exploit what we ourselves are good at. I have to get this done. I have to pull an all-nighter. I have to exploit my own limited personal resources to get this done because it matters for X, Y, Z reason. And maybe it's true, but the blowback of those decisions are destructive results. We destroy our health in the process, right?
Interesting. Yes, absolutely.
So how do we make use of things? And when we think of it in terms of that, then we think in terms of, okay, what do I need to do so that this person that I can make use of feels good about this and can do their best work and can walk away still able to do their best work, right? That creates an environment where everyone is not only uplifted, but they are re-energized by the process of being made use of. In other words, what I'm saying is we need to give the Malkovich hug.
Oh, yeah, that's what we need. That's exactly right.
Now, this is an interesting reaction that you get from people about dark comedies. One of the things is, why is it called a comedy?
No, right?
Because some people can't laugh at this. But not being able to laugh is actually the definition of a dark comedy. That you are aware of where the comedy is and you can't laugh at it. Not because it's not funny, but because, oh my God, that's not funny.
That's not funny. Exactly. Yes. You see that in stand-up acts all the time where you're laughing and you shouldn't be laughing, or you know it's funny and you can't laugh. And, you know, some people say, well, that's offensive.
Do you know how you can always tell if something is brilliantly darkly comedic?
How?
If Phil Larenas is the only person laughing.
It's true. I've heard you laugh at jokes in comedy clubs that no one else is laughing at, and you're killing yourself at something so dark. You are the darkness in the light. I don't know how to explain that.
The
really,
light in the darkness. I go there because it keeps me sane, quite honestly. It helps me to be a better person. But did you think it was funny?
I did, actually. Well, I thought Jamie Keller, holy smokes, I knew he was doing great work on set, but seeing it all together and now seeing also, you know, the tribulations he came through, but how all of that was just rolling off him made me laugh all the more, actually. I thought Jamie's performance was particularly the way you cut it together. And again, here's the testament of how a performance is in the hand of the editor, that the timing, the comedic timing of him shone all the more brightly.
And, you know, one of the keys to his comedic performance is that everything, you know, when he would be in scenes, no matter who he was with, whether it be you or Bert or Ari, he took such joy and found so funny what each of you were doing.
Right.
And
it's true.
And that's what brought the comedy out of him. And that's who his character was. And that's the thing that, you know, is really also some interesting acting jujitsu is just because a character embody or is exploring or living, inhabiting a really dark or depressing or dramatic place doesn't mean that the performer should be joyless.
Right.
The character might be joyless, but you can, as an actor, joyfully participate in the sorrow of what's being explored. And by the way, that might be the key to living itself.
Hey,
joyfully participating in the sorrow. And hopefully we help you do that a little bit each and every week on your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. If you want to learn more about the Lady Killers, and we'll, God knows we'll talk more about it in the weeks to come. We've got a free screening of it in San Leandro, California on Thursday night at 7 p.m. at the historic Bal Theater, BALTHEATRE.com. Tickets are free. I'm going to be there. And the movie's out on DVD. It's out on a variety of on-demand platforms. You can learn everything you need to learn at theladykillersmovie.com, theladykillersmovie.com. We are so over time.
Oh, my gosh.
Dean Haglund.
Sorry.
No.
My fault.
No, but we wanted to talk about our movie. We didn't want to shortchange talking about other people's movies, so we waited to talk about our movie. We will talk more about it when it becomes relevant, and God knows with every news cycle, it seems to get a little more relevant.
Yeah, for sure.
So why don't we just say that we hope we've been helping you joyfully participate in the sorrow these many 11 years we've been doing this.
Right?
And,
that's helpful.
And that I will update people on what's going on with our friend Lee McCloskey on next week's show. You know, Lee is performing Lily and My wedding.
Right.
And
Good Lord.
So if I may be selfish to the universe just a little bit, please don't let his house burn.
Yes, please. That would be a lovely thing.
Yeah. So
okay.
Anyway, with that plea in place, I'm your friend in podcasting, Phil Lernis. Till next week.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.